Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello again, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. This is Michael Mancello, and I'm here today to speak with Dr. Donald Stern about his most recent book, Relational Freedom. Dr. Stern is a psychoanalyst and psychotherapist in private practice in New York City, where he also serves as training and supervising analyst at the William Allison White Institute, as well as adjunct clinical professor and consultant at the NYU postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. He is the founder and editor of Psychoanalysis in a New Key, a book series put up by Routledge, which is publishing much of the more exciting work being done in psychoanalysis today. Hello, Dr. Stern. Thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So one of the things I appreciated most about this book was a series of chapters in which you outlined a sort of history of psychoanalytic conceptions of authority and dogma and the analyst's place. We move from Sullivan and Fromm to the world of contemporary Freudians and interpersonalists, and in the course of this review, we get a sense of a young man entering the psychoanalytic world and finding this world to be divided. In a later chapter of your Relational Freedom, you compare the psychoanalytic schools and the people who inhabit them to an intimate family who can grow annoyed with each other at times, as family members inevitably do. So my first question for you is, how did you yourself first enter this world of psychoanalysis? What brought you into the family?
What was the last question?
Oh, what?
The last sentence?
Sure. What brought you into the family?
Oh, into the family. Okay. Well, my background is like many people who become psychoanalysts, not a straight arrow. My undergraduate training was in experimental psychology, and I started graduate school in comparative psychology at the University of Wisconsin, where I was the last graduate student of a man named Harry Harlow, who was one of the most prominent experimental or comparative psychologists and experimentalists of his day. But it wasn't right for me. I had been doing studying the social behavior of stump-tailed macaques, those are monkeys, for some years. I thought I was going to go into comparative psychology or zoology or something, physical anthropology, one of those three. But I decided that while I was at Wisconsin, it just didn't feel right to me. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life transferring monkeys from cage to cage. And I went back to California, where I spent a year working and feeling very anxious about my future, working in a variety of jobs. There's a lot of funny stories about them, which I won't tell you now, but that was quite a year. And the following year, I started graduate school in clinical psychology. I went to a place that had both psychoanalytic and behavioral orientations because I didn't think I knew enough to make a choice. Mm-hmm. But it turns out it wasn't necessary because when I got there, I had to make a decision during the first week about whether to take a practicum that was run by a guy who called himself an ego psychologist but was really a social learning theorist, and then the other guy was an old-fashioned drive theorist. And the psychoanalysis is what drew me. So I went that direction. I never looked back. During the years I was in Michigan, I saw five people, four of them 4 days a week. So by the time I was I'm about 24, 25 years old. I've already done a lot of analysis. And then I decided to take another change of direction, and I did a postdoc in neuropsychology, which had also been a long-term interest, at the University of Iowa with a man who's sort of the grandfather of American neuropsychology, a man named Arthur Penn. I really did enjoy that. I learned a lot, but I didn't feel I could talk to my colleagues about the things that mattered to me in the way I had when I'd been in graduate school and clinical. So I left there, despite the fact that I had gathered funding for myself for a number of years. I just left it behind and came to New York to become a psychoanalyst. I had enough money from selling my car to go to interviews in either San Francisco or Los Angeles, or San Francisco or New York. There were more places in New York, so I came here. Didn't know what I was doing. The man who trained me in graduate school was not himself a trained psychoanalyst, so I didn't know exactly what I was, where I was going or what I was choosing, but I interviewed at places I found in a book from the American Psychological Association, and I liked the White Institute. I had been taught to have great respect for both Freud and Sullivan, and that's what I found there. So I ended up going to White, and it turns out to have been a good decision. I always knew I wanted to write, so once I got there, I, before too long, started to do that. Does that answer your question?
It does, although it's a shame we won't hear about the crazy stories of your hand-to-mouth period.
Yeah, well, I'll give you one short paragraph. During one particularly distressing week, I was learning to sell rainbow vacuum cleaners door-to-door in the ghetto, and it would have been a tough job. I never quite got there because Friday, they were thrilled to have me. They thought they had some. They thought they had a good one. I was going to be a salesman for the Rainbow Vacuum Cleaner Company, but I got a job at the end of the week. Monday we were going to go out. Monday I started as an unemployment insurance adjuster, so I didn't have to do it. But the man who taught us in that Rainbow Vacuum Cleaners wore a succession of taxi cab and banana yellow suits.
My God.
That's all he ever wore. And he insisted that we call him Mr. Big Banana.
You're kidding.
So if you tried to say something, or if you had a question, and you say, excuse me, he'd say, what did I say? Excuse me, Mr. Big Banana, you had to say.
I envy whoever analyzed Mr. Banana. Mr. Big Banana.
Yeah, I don't think you do.
I noticed just now, you know, you were talking about how you found your way, and you do something that, you know, you do in the book as well, which is mentioning all these figures and people and schools of thought, and how they were attached to a certain time, and you speak at length about how you've noticed this world changing, you know, how the psychoanalytic world has been changing in response to changes in the larger culture, and in turn, how the psychoanalytic world has been perpetuating changes of its own. Could you explain where you think Anna Lizanne's find themselves now? What do you think they want in the way of cooperation and inspiration from an analyst that they wouldn't have thought to want maybe 50, 60 years ago?
Oh, you know, the analytic world has changed a great deal in the last 50 or 60 years. I don't know that I go back quite that far. Let's see, I came into it I started my training in 1976, my analytic training. That's after that postdoc. Mm-hmm. So that's 24, that's 40 years, 24 and 15. I can tell you from that vantage point, you know, when I came to New York, the dominant form of psychoanalysis was really still ego-psychology. Mm-hmm. And I had a great interest in ego-psychology, actually. I found it elegant and beautiful, but I didn't agree with a lot of it. Mm. And over the years of my training and thereafter, I started to get much more interested in what the interpersonal situation contributed, the context contributed by way of what parts of a person became actualized in any particular interaction. that's the interpersonal point of view. And at that time, there wasn't a relational point of view. It hadn't come about yet. It was a few years before that. So interpersonal psychoanalysis was really the only alternative in New York to the Freudian psychoanalysis of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very difficult time for interpersonalists because there was a really sort of a hegemonic relationship between those two schools. The Freudian school was very dominant and very dismissive.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened in the years since then has been that there's been something that's, I think, fair to call the interpersonalization of psychoanalysis in this country anyway, in North America. So that the Freudian group discovered the significance of things like the interpersonal situation, the interaction, enactment,
mm-hmm.
and now uses all those things routinely, not always with attribution. In fact, quite often they feel that they've discovered those things independently. But there has been a very heavy influence of interpersonal psychoanalysis over those decades, and has changed the field a great deal. It was probably the heart, interpersonal psychoanalysis was the heart of relational psychoanalysis, which came about in the early 80s. The people who started relational psychoanalysis were, many of us were trained as interpersonalists, Steve Mitchell and Jay Greenberg and Philip Bromberg and me and Darlene Ehrenberg and Edgar Levinson. Then there were there's a substantial group of relational analysts who were trained in other ways as well. But Steve, who it was the figurehead of the group, Steve Mitchell, was himself an interpersonal psychoanalyst and felt that that was the heart of his views. So that I think relational psychoanalysis has had a very heavy influence on contemporary Freudian psychoanalysis in this country. It's not so easy for them, but they've been living with us. They know us. Those in New York here, we're all colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
So it's they've been influenced by direct influence, osmosis, interaction, and so that's one thing that's happened in these years. Has been the interpersonalization, I think, of the field. Currently, we're going through a period in which there's a very large, in between there was also self-psychology, of course. Cohut became very significant in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, for reasons I don't fully understand, self-psychology has moved off and it sort of exists independently from the rest of psychoanalysis much more than it did when Cohut was alive. They have their own organizations. Today, within the mainstream of psychoanalysis, in particular, Bionian ideas have become really influential. It's all true all up and down the West Coast, and it's true in certain parts of the East Coast, though probably a little less so. Boston, in particular, does have a fairly heavy Bionian presence. These theoretical developments have happened during that time. You asked about authority relations, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
That's changed. Yeah, that's changed a lot, too. Because, back in the day, in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, even all the way through the 70s, most analysts, not interpersonalists, but most analysts understood what they were doing as an interpretive discipline. They offered the correct interpretation by passing this packet of information between themselves and the patient that the patient was supposed to get better. That was the understanding of therapeutic action. It was insight.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way that interpersonalists understood therapeutic action. It had much more to do with the states of relatedness. That changed in the intervening years. But the authority of the analyst was all wrapped up in this because for traditional analysts, the analyst knew that the content of the patient's mind. That was never quite as true as what I just said, as that sentence makes it sound, but
mm-hmm.
the analyst, part of the analyst's expertise was to know what was going on in the patient and to tell the patient about it. From an interpersonal and then a relational perspective, it's much more a matter of finding out together what something that really neither of you knows in a collaborative fashion. And so that means that the analyst doesn't know what's in the patient's mind, and is the relationship, well, of course, there are, it's asymmetrical in the sense that the patient and analyst have different roles. It's entirely symmetrical or egalitarian on a common human basis. We have reactions to one another of the same kind, patients and analysts.
Right. It reminds me of two anecdotes from your book, Partners in Thought. One where you reference the aphorism that the greatest myth about psychoanalysis is that it's about a healthy person curing a sick person. And
That's Hacker.
That's Hacker. And you mentioned...
Racker.
Oh, Racker.
Heinrich Racker, yeah.
Right. And you mentioned in that same chapter, I think, this joke about this drunk man walking home who drops his key in the dark. And when he gets to a spot with a bit more light, he finds this fellow who helps him look for his key. And obviously they can't find it. And the companion asks the drunkard, where did you drop your key? And the drunkard points far off in the distance back into the darkness. And his companion says, well, why aren't we looking over there? And then the drunkard says, because it's dark over there. And
well, actually, the way the story goes is the guy asks the drunkard, where did you lose your keys? And he's pointing off into the darkness, and he says to the drunkard, then why are you looking here?
Mm-hmm.
And the drunk says, well, because I can see. The idea being that if he went out in the dark where he lost his keys, he'd never find them if he can't see anything.
Right. Which may bear resemblance to more technique, heavy ideas of psychoanalysis, rather than the idea of being attentive to the snags in the relationship between analyst and analysand, and working in the dark, groping towards something.
Yeah, that's right. And you're mistaken that story comes from relational freedom. It comes from Partners in Thought, but it's a good mistake. That's the only reason I'm willing to label it as such, because it shows that you read that book too.
Mm-hmm.
That story comes from one of the chapters near the end of Partners in Thought. Mm-hmm. And so does that word snags and chafing. Those words come from that book also.
Right. You mentioned this early on in your response, and I'd like to return to it. What exactly did you find elegant about drive theory?
No, not drive theory, ego psychology.
Oh, ego psychology.
Yeah. Well, ego psychology is very elegant. It's very, it's very exacting and precise, and it isn't necessarily very realistic, but it's very beautiful. Hartman, Chris Lowenstein, and Rappaport really worked hard, and Merton Gill also in his own way, at putting things together in a way that was convincing from that perspective. It was a very incomplete perspective, I think, in the end. Left a lot of passion and feeling out. But the truth is that, drive theory has its appeal to me also. Not as a biological way of thinking, but as a way of bringing or keeping, the powerful passions in psychoanalysis. So there is whether I call that beauty or not, I don't know, but it's really impossible to read world literature in psychoanalysis without some sort of notion of drive. For example, you can't read Andre Green at all without accepting some notion of drive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of something that you talk about towards the end of Relational Freedom, when you have the final chapter on curiosity, and you talk about the two ideal schools, one of which would retain what was valuable from past psychoanalytic theories. Would you be willing to talk about that a bit, those two schools?
Yes, if I can remember it. That article is on, it's on curiosity, but I think it's called something like Curiosity and the Ideal Psychoanalytic Institute.
Dealing with divergent ideas in the Ideal Psychoanalytic Institute.
Yes. The word curiosity is in there somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the it's curiosity and then colon dealing with the
yeah. ideas. Right. That paper was written for a special issue of Contemporary Psychoanalysis it may have been on the Ideal Institute, actually, or it may just have been on psychoanalytic training. Somebody else who I think you've interviewed, Sandy Buechler.
Mm-hmm.
Did you interview, or somebody interviewed her for this program? Sandy is one of the writers who, I have a book series at Routledge called Psychoanalysis and the New Key, and Sandy has done 4 books now in it. Anyway, Sandy edited that issue of Contemporary Psychoanalysis, and I wrote this article for it. And in it, I was...
Hello? It appears that we've lost Dr. Stern for a moment.
Curiosity.
Dr. Stern, sorry, the connection gave out for a moment.
Oh, okay, where were we?
You were just talking about how you... it was just a few seconds ago. You were talking about Sandy?
I see. Okay, so I just mentioned that Sandy Buechler was... who's written several books and published them in my series, was the editor of the issue on the Ideal Psychoanalytic Institute in which this paper appeared. And in the paper, I argued that the most important thing about an analytic institute is how it deals with otherness, with what's not the point of view that it represents. In my training, it was always idealized, actually. Not always, it was not always observed, but quite often idealized, the idea of a comparative psychoanalysis, that it's important to think about the different ways of thinking in psychoanalysis and not simply to avail yourself of one of them. Even though where I went was an institute that is associated with the interpersonal point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always felt that that was the right attitude. So for me, curiosity is the biggest protection, the maintenance of curiosity, the biggest protection against the rejection of what's foreign simply because it's alien to us or other or different. So I laid out a couple of ways of thinking about ways of training. One of them, I don't remember now the names of the two. You don't have to remember them, do you?
I do. It's the accretion model and yeah. The revolution model.
Yeah, okay, very good. So in the accretion model, the idea is that you are curious about each thing you come across, and you try to find a way of accommodating all the different ways of thinking, getting rid of what you need to get rid of when you think it's no longer useful. But it's a much less radical way of proceeding than the revolution model, which is that when curiosity leads you to a place where the old ways don't seem adequate, throwing them out and beginning again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the conclusion I came to at the end of the paper was, you know, we really need both attitudes. We need to be willing to think and proceed in both these ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the most, to me, captivating parts of the book, one of the most captivating historical retellings was, funnily enough, to be found in the footnotes. You take us back to 1946, when Karen Horney's controversial class on cultural factors in psychoanalysis was restricted by the New York Psychoanalytic, where Horney worked at the time. It was restricted to fourth-year students over her objections because it was deemed too controversial. In response to this, and I'll quote you here, in response to this action, the story goes, a group of senior analysts, young analysts, and candidates left the institute and walked down the avenue singing, "Go down, Moses, let my people go." They eventually banded together and formed a new institute, the American Institute of Psychoanalysis, headed by Horney, unquote. Now, not long after that, many important interpersonal thinkers and thinkers left the American Institute of Psychoanalysis, I believe, in your retelling, because Fromm was denied teaching privileges for...
Well, yeah, I didn't get that story quite right. And it turns out, I found out in retrospect, that Horney was denied teaching privileges at New York. It wasn't just that she was moved to the fourth year.
Oh.
But other than that, it's right.
Oh, wow.
And then, so it's somewhat more extreme.
Right.
And then, yes, something similar happened at the American Institute of Psychoanalysis, where the two original training analysts were Hornein and Fromm.
Mm-hmm.
And Fromm was thought that, what happened is apparently the candidates all ended up going to Hornein, and we were sort of routed or shunted there in some fashion, and there was more and more bad blood between her and Fromm.
Mm-hmm.
And Fromm was eventually told that he was no longer welcome to be a training analyst. And at that point, there was another schism, as there has been so often in psychoanalysis, and that's where the White Institute came from.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if I remember correctly, the reason that Hornei provided, whether or not it's the whole story, in your telling, is because he had a PhD but not an MD. Is that that's correct?
Apparently, that's part of it. There were lots of, it was complicated things going on there, but that was apparently cited as one of the reasons. Yeah.
Right.
So then Hornei stayed with her original institute, but Clara Thompson and Eric Fromm and a bunch of their students and William Silverberg left the American Institute and started teaching classes in New York, but they had to do it through, it turns out, the Washington School of Psychiatry for the first 3 years in Washington, D.C. And they were joined because of the connection with the Washington group. Those people were joined by Harry Stack Sullivan at that point, who was not himself trained as an analyst, but who was willing to join this group. And several others, Frieda von Reichmann. You know who von Reichmann is, probably.
Yes.
Yeah. Harold Searles was not a member of this group, but he during those years he studied with Sullivan in Washington and had his one foot in the interpersonal group.
Mm.
Then it wasn't until 1946 and that, the White Institute actually was formally established in New York, and then there was a long history about the relations with the American Psychoanalytic Association, which you may or may not want to go into now. But there has been a big change recently. The White Institute has just joined.
Has just joined the
American Psychoanalytic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm. And so it's. That anecdote regarding Fromm stuck me as interesting in the context of the work as a whole, because there seems to be a current running through the piece regarding the identity of the analyst as doctor, as someone engaged in a scientific craft, or as someone engaged in a humanistic art. You focus on this rather explicitly in a later chapter, and it's foreshadowed in earlier chapters too. For instance, when you talk about Sullivan and Fromm as being essentially equally influential fathers of the movement, but Sullivan not really identifying it as an analyst. And so I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the pressures within psychoanalysis for analysts to provide, you know, sort of empirical proofs of the efficiency of their treatment.
Oh, all right. Well, yeah, that's, I didn't realize you were going to go there. I was preparing for a different question about humanistic and so on and so forth, but we can work in both those things.
Sure.
You know, I came, as I told you before, I came up through a fairly hard-headed empirical background.
Mm-hmm.
I have no complaint about research in the right context, but the research that's available in psychotherapy is mostly very problematic. Now, I have to be fair about this because some of my colleagues, some people who I actually am fairly close to, do some of this work, empirical, quantitative research to psychotherapy, and certainly there are many people who believe that unless we do it, we're sunk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't have any argument with doing it. I think that's fine. I just, what I take issue with is the same thing that that my friend Erwin Hoffman takes issue with. The piece that you're referring to was actually written as a companion piece to a piece of his. And the idea is that we argue with the privileging of empirical quantitative data in any kind of decision making about what's an appropriate way to proceed as a psychoanalyst. If you're using empirical research simply as one source of inspiration, like case histories or reading philosophy or anything else, making you think differently about the experience you're having with the patient, giving you a tool, a way of maybe making something different with it, that's fine. Mm-hmm. I want to avoid there being any sort of imposition of techniques or aims or goals or measures of success that are leveled against or on psychoanalysis and are used to measure it. It makes it into something instrumental, and I don't think it is. You mentioned the difference between humanistic and scientific. Yes, I do come down on the humanistic side of it. On the other hand, in that same article, if you'll remember, I also say that I think the ideal attitude is the physicianly attitude, the attitude that a physician has toward his patient. It's much, much better, as far as I'm concerned, than the attitude that a lawyer or an accountant or some other kind of professional has, because the physicianly attitude, ever since the Oath of Hippocrates, has focused on a certain responsibility that the physician has to the patient. Now, as an analyst, you don't have a responsibility to make the patient better, but you do have a responsibility to provide a certain kind of care. And that's different than the responsibility that other service providers have, I think. So in that sense, I don't mind at all being thought of as physicianly, but I don't want to be tied down to empirical data and to evidence-based, solutions to treatment quandaries.
Sure, and it also, at this late stage of psychoanalysis, in today's psychoanalytic world, there are all sorts of questions as regard what getting better can mean or look like. It seems as though there's a different form of getting better for every patient.
Yeah, the problem is medical insurance. Mm-hmm. The problem that we have is largely due to the medical system that we exist in. Psychotherapy and psychoanalysis are considered to be medical treatments in the context of medical insurance reimbursement policies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, because they're looking at them as medical procedures, as long as they're paying the bills, they probably do have the right to insist that they get to choose the ways that they are going to define how people get better. And that is a problem for us. I think it's a major problem for psychoanalysts to participate in insurance reimbursement systems, but there's no way that you can avoid it. I think there are lots of things that have to do with getting better, as you put it, that don't have to do with medical criteria at all. The vitality, sense of agency, and so on. I mean, we could make up a list of these things that are obviously not on the docket of a list when there's an insurance review being done on your telephone with somebody who has a UBH insurance. Mm-hmm. They don't ask about the patient's sense of vitality or sense of the growing sense of agency.
There's no existential
on the other
checklist.
Hand, huh?
Yeah, there's no existential checklist.
That's right. But on the other hand, it's also true that I'm not happy if I'm working with someone who has problems that that can be thought of as, in the vaguest sense, medical, for example, just feeling bad. If what I'm doing, even though what I'm doing is not point by point set out to make the person better, because in psychoanalysis we don't believe that we have the choice of doing that, still, the way we do proceed, if it doesn't result in symptom alleviation, would make me unhappy if it didn't work to alleviate symptoms. I wouldn't be happy with the treatment. I'd have to question what's the matter.
Mm-hmm. In this line of thought, I feel compelled to mention how delighted I was to find the interdisciplinary references throughout this book. You discuss artists, writers, and in fact spend some time talking about or referencing the ideas of Frank Kermode and Harold Bloom, which was really a wonder to see. I also appreciated your joke that not all psychoanalytic writers are necessarily prose stylists.
Very few.
Now, your book, among other things, is about ambiguity and becoming comfortable standing in the spaces, to borrow Bromberg's phrase. And literature, as opposed to, what insurance companies would rather see in the way of sort of univocal facts, literature seems to present us with opportunities to exist in ambiguity and be just safe enough to encounter selves that may be uncomfortable. And seeing as how you included a number of literary allusions in the text, I was wondering what to you can literature teach psychoanalysis, or what can it lend to the psychoanalyst who identifies himself with, more of the humanist side?
Well, okay. Let me first say something about your use of this word uncertainty or ambiguity. I'm probably best known for the idea of unformulated experience, which was the title of my first book and my first paper in psychoanalysis in 1983, which is a way of understanding the unconscious differently than it's understood in traditional terms. It's a way of understanding the unconscious as potential experience that has not yet come into being. And rather than go into that in any detail, I just want to mention it because it's part of my orientation that I think it really leads. It's part of everything I do, that notion of what experience is like. In regard to your question about literature, ever since I've been a kid, it seemed to me that that's the real writing. Literature, fiction and poetry, that's the real writing. And the people who really move me the most are writers of fiction and poetry. I went into the field with the idea that I wanted to be able to say something that would carry as much conviction and depth as Dostoevsky, Freud had his share of this, Dostoevsky though, or Graham Greene, or any of the great character writers who you might think of. And I still think that those are the most instructive portraits of people. Word portraits. The ones that are contributed by our writers of fiction. I aspire to a level of feeling and depth that I read in fiction.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you talk in both, I believe, Relational Freedom and Partners in Thought about a certain type of analyst who will treat his analysand the same way that a literary critic would treat an author.
Of course, I'm taking issue with that statement when I bring it up.
Exactly. And I was wondering if you could expand a bit about what you find unsatisfactory about this sort of textual treatment of
relations. Sure. I mean, that was a quotation from Roy Schaefer, who I was careful to say when I wrote this down, and it's certainly true that in most respects, he's been a source of inspiration to be a major influence. Schaefer had more to do probably than anyone else with bringing hermeneutics into psychoanalysis. But in this particular passage that I took issue with, what he's saying is that the analyst treats the patient the way a critic treats a text. And the context is that the subject matter is about the patient who talks back, which means the patient who has something to say about the analyst's interpretation that's less than, you know, simply accepting. And surprisingly to me, in a certain way, I guess Schaefer's attitude is, well, there's a certain autonomous critical command that the textual critic believes that he or she has, and that the analyst should take the same attitude. So that if the patient has some sort of difference or objection with the interpretation given by the analyst should take that as one more thing to be interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
I don't disagree with that, but it's quite partial, because you also need to listen to the patient, and what it leaves out is the unconscious involvement of the analyst, because every interpretation, every thought, everything you do with the patient has an unconscious part to it on the part of the analyst. The analyst is always unconsciously involved with the patient, just as the patient's unconsciously involved with the analyst, and for Schaefer that isn't necessarily true. So he can take this attitude. I would listen to what the patient said about a thing like that with the attitude of trying to understand what I might learn about the nature of my involvement in the idea that I had just conveyed, and what we might how it might be modified, made more effective, might be revealed what something more about what it's about and what the nature of my involvement with the patient is, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Does that get to what you're asking?
Absolutely, absolutely, and it leads us to a rather beautiful passage that you have near the end of your book, which I'll quote for our listeners. You say, "The patient is open to his own mind, and so is the analyst, who can't really attend to the patient per se, but only to his or her experience of the patient. And so when I am attending to my patient, I am attending to my own mind, trying to allow myself whatever is novel and what emerges for me." Now, some may read that and say, ah, he's attending to his own mind, this is therefore an intrapsychic analytic model, but I think you anticipate this argument, and immediately after this passage, you paint a picture of the mind as social. Could you talk a bit about how maybe focusing on the social interdependent nature of the mind between analyst and analysand can lead to constructive work with, say, myopic enactments or other impediments to relational freedom?
Well, I think of the mind as distributed. I don't think of it as existing inside the head, inside the skull.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as existing inside the field. And the field is always larger than an individual, even when you're alone. There are imaginary people with you. So anything that happens with the patient and me takes place in a field between us, and in which both of us are involved. So I, in order to make some sense out of something that I can't make sense of, I'm going to have to understand not only the patient's contribution, but my own.
Mm-hmm.
And there always is one. So you're always asking yourself the question, when you have a thought about the patient, let's say, that you think might be helpful, well, but what might this mean in terms of the nature of my involvement with the patient that I'm not yet able to attend to? You ask about enactments. To me, an enactment is a very particular thing. It's what I refer to as the interpersonalization of dissociation. What I mean by that is let me just do a little sidebar there. Most people who talk about enactment these days are simply talking about the unconscious part of the analyst's involvement with the patient. That's continuous. Because it's continuous, because you can find something of that in any particular piece of the treatment you want to examine, the word enactment doesn't have a very specific meaning anymore. It's always there. So I wanted to specify the meaning of the word so that it could remain more useful, and that's why I refer to it as the interpersonalization of dissociation. For me, an enactment is what happens as the last-ditch effort to prevent what Sullivan called and what Phil Bromberg and I have called not me, from entering and taking over awareness.
Mm-hmm.
In order, if that should happen, not me is the part of the person who is not organized itself. It's not recognizable to you as yourself. It's what I cannot, must not be. So the idea is that if that part of you, and that part of you is a funny way of referring to it because it's not self, let's say that part of your subjectivity were to take over awareness, you would not be recognizable to yourself. This is very disturbing. So people will do a great deal to avoid it. And the last ditch effort that you can do is to attribute it when circumstances call it into prominence in your conscious mind, attribute it instead to the other person. So it's, I'm not, let's say, make something up that's not good. I'm not greedy. You're greedy. And an interaction gets put together in which the analyst is characterized as precisely the thing that the patient can't tolerate being. Or it could work the other way around, too. But for the sake of simplicity, we can just say this starts with the patient here.
Mm-hmm.
The analyst is generally, there are only so many things that are dissociated in life. There's a lot of overlap between what different people dissociate. And so the analyst is going to have a problem with the way the patient treats him under these circumstances. The patient's going to treat him as if he's bad in some way. Most enactments have an adversarial quality. They're uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
If the analyst can't figure out the nature of his or her involvement in their end of it, they're not going to be able to say something that's going to allow that dissociation to come home to roost in the patient's mind. I spent a lot of time writing about this over the last 15 years or so. Excuse me. I'm tickling my throat. The last book, Partners in Thought, had one chapter in particular called The I Sees Itself, which was originally an article in which this set of ideas is laid out with what I hope is clarity. So, yes, the analyst has to pay attention to his own, her own experience. No, I wouldn't say that's intrapsychic because for an intrapsychic analyst, the traditional kind, the most traditional kind, the analyst isn't very involved at all.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about what's going on in the patient, and the analyst is a subjective observer from the outside who's giving interpretations that are supposedly going to unlock the patient's mind for him. But from an interpersonal or relational point of view, because the analyst is involved, the only way that this thing can come together, this enactment, it now involves both of them, because it involves the analyst's reaction to what the patient's doing with him, which is quite often not conscious. Unless the analyst can come to that and make some kind of sense out of it, emotional sense, he's not going to be able to treat the patient any differently, liable to get defensive, and the patient isn't going to be able to profit from the enactment. Enactments are terribly important, though, because they're not symbolized. They're unformulated experience. And because they're not part of the self, all of that's true. They're dissociated, they're unformulated experience, they're not part of the self. They can't be discussed. The material that's represented in enactments can't be discussed. It can't be even pointed at because it has no symbolic existence in the mind. It's not represented in any way. The only way it can come into the treatment is via enactment. And if you can't use that enactment profitably, you lose the opportunity to expand the boundaries of the self, which is what happens when not me becomes me. And I took you on a very rapid tour of a fairly wide landscape there. What I would say to people who are listening is that if what I've just said whets your appetite, take a look at the chapter called The I Sees Itself in the book called Partners in Thought. But the whole line of thought is also present in this book, Relational Freedom, especially in chapter 5, which has the title Relational Freedom.
Right, right. And you talk... to return to, you know, the analyst as involved with the analyst and not sort of standing on his perch, as you reference the idea in Partners in Thought, the mythical perch where the analyst is objective and can look at the countertransference and everything that's going on without being unconsciously influenced by
right.
the countertransference. You talk in Relational Freedom about an implicit theory that the analyst uses to grope about in the field. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the shape of an implicit theory. Is set theory unformulated? Is it groping in the dark? Does it, as I believe it does, is it stemming from personal feeling and passion as opposed to sort of hard-nosed following manualized technique? What would you like to say about implicit theory?
Well, you know, I think that I didn't say this in that chapter, I don't think, although I've said it elsewhere, but I do have the impression that all creative thought works this way, including the creation of theory and psychoanalysis. There's a really nice passage from a mathematician by the name of Marston Morse, M-O-R-S-E, which I think I quoted in Unformulated Experience. What he says is, the mathematician reaches into the sky, metaphorically, and pulls down a pattern for beauty's sake. And only after that does he make some kind of, you know, more rational sense out of it. I think all creative thinking is, to an important extent, not rational at all. It comes about spontaneously, unbidden, to use a word that I often use. We are sort of a conduit for it. It comes into being through us. Now, in this particular chapter, the idea is that the theories, explicit theories in psychoanalysis, were once implicit theories. They were created on the basis of the personal experience and the insightful sort of a cogitation about it of the people who wrote the theories. But before they wrote them, and all of us, every day, are continuously forming them. We're forming ideas about, sometimes the theories are about something broad, like, you know, everybody. Sometimes they're much more particular, like something that I think works with this particular person. And I begin to maybe throw it around a little bit without even being aware of it. How come? Why would that be? What would he have to be feeling in order for me to be able to say this in such a way that it has this kind of impact on him? All those things are implicit theories. That article, or then the chapter that was based on the article, takes the position that theories of technique and therapeutic action are all statements of values, but that we don't generally examine how value-laden our theories are. Every theory in psychoanalysis is a statement of a value. The theories of psychopathology, theories of, like, what is it that's good and bad about human life? What's a good thing to aim for? What do we understand to be problematic? Those are value positions. What is psychoanalysis aimed to do? Well, in order to answer that, you have to be able to say something about what you think the good life is. Mm-hmm. And that's a value position. How do you influence, you know, someone to think more widely or deeply about something? Those end up being value positions too, because it depends upon what you're aiming at least partly. So I was arguing for an acceptance of the degree of significance that values have in our implicit theories, the ones that we operate on in our offices all day, and then the significance of implicit theories in our conduct from one day to the next and in our eventual construction of explicit theory.
Mm-hmm. And you have a chapter, or a section, actually I believe a whole chapter containing a clinical case study in which you talk about a patient of yours, and you felt that you had an idea of a good life that didn't really coincide with his idea of the good life. The wider issue in the clinical case, if I remember correctly, was simply that you two had an emotional connection that was necessary but not sufficient, it proved. But there is a section there where you talk about differing ideas of the good life between...
I don't know that we conflicted exactly. I know which chapter you're referring to. It's called something about the difficult, the hard-to-engage patient.
Mm-hmm.
I know the passage you're talking about. I think what I said was that we usually think of this as some sort of a failure to get across what we're trying to get across or to make something happen. He and I were very friendly with one another. We felt simpatico with one another. He'd been in many different treatments that just hadn't worked out. And he was hopeful about this one, as I was, because we hit it off so well. But eventually he just kept saying the same things over and over again. It was very hard for him to be very curious. And I think that was the big problem. And in the article, I speculate about how come, you know, his curiosity was blunted in the way it was. It was not blunted in many other respects. He was intellectually a highly gifted man. But in terms of his certain aspects of his emotional life, it had the sharpness of a hammer. Which is to say, it wasn't very sharp. And at the end, when eventually things petered out, it's about the failure of a treatment, that particular chapter. Mm-hmm. And when eventually things petered out, and we both acknowledged sadly that it wasn't going to work, I said, you know, I shouldn't assume that my values about what's important in life are necessarily his or what's best for him. And that was part of what I was left with. I don't think there was a conflict exactly, but, you know, there are people for whom psychotherapy is probably not the best kind of intervention.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Stern. It's been a sincere pleasure to speak with you about your new book, Relational Freedom, and I encourage our listeners to give it a read as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you again for having me.
My pleasure. For now, this is Michael Mangello of New Books in Psychoanalysis, signing off.